Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that followed the rules like a stupid muppet it is. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey Corey.
This weekend was a bank holiday weekend. It also marked 1 year since the resignation of Theresa May. And in many ways, Steve, I felt a return to the May era because I spent the bits of the bank holiday I did spend looking at the news. I stared at it in slack-jawed incomprehension at the cluster wallace the government's got itself into. Dominic Cummings, the Prime Minister's closest advisor, had travelled 260 miles with coronavirus symptoms and then drove another 30 miles to test his eyesight. I understand that it is lockdown and opticians are shut, but surely there are better ways of checking your eyesight's okay than this.
One would imagine there would be. Just off the top of my head, I could position my laptop screen like on a table and take steps back from it. I could change the font size of the words on the document and just see exactly how good or easy it was for me to see fonts at a certain distance.
I'm standing in my living room. I can read car number plates from here. And the nice thing is, obviously, you've got lots of different car number plates, lots of distances away. So this is quite easy to also check for eyesight, literally without leaving the house.
I mean, maybe that's what Dominic Cummings was trying to do. Maybe there, because he was on a Durham farm estate, there wasn't a lot of cars around for him to actually just like stare at and at different distances. So we had to go to a drive to Barnard Castle in order to see lots of different cars and test his eyesight that way. Maybe that's it. Maybe it's all just a misunderstanding.
Maybe it's a generational thing, because Michael Gove was on Sky earlier saying that he also would drive to prove his eyesight work.
Yeah, and there's just a beautiful video. I think it's with Nick Ferrari from LBC, where Gove is in the middle of kind of making this claim, and you can just watch Gove's face as he realises what he's gotten himself into. And Nick Ferrari basically says, "Yeah, I'm looking forward to see how you're going to get out of this one." It was just such a ludicrous statement. Ferrari knew it was ludicrous. Gove knew it was ludicrous, but Gove was already halfway in the hole, so he just decided to keep on digging.
A good interview with Kay Burley as well on Michael Gove. Interesting that Gove brought up the subject of driving, because as he himself said, he'd failed his driving test 7 times, not the biggest authority on the subject.
Yeah, one of my favourite things throughout all of this was Gove saying, "Yeah, no, I'm not actually an expert on driving and transport," which has just made everybody on Twitter go, "Let's grab Grant Shapps, let's ask the transport minister and transport secretary what he thinks about this."
Michael Gove famously had enough of experts, so that could be part of it as well. I mean, yeah. we could sit for half an hour and we could poke lots of holes in Cummings' story. I had to switch off his press conference yesterday at that. Well, I just went to test my eyesight, so I drove to a castle. Because Barnard Castle is a village,
place.
Not a castle. Yeah. First mistake, 2 minutes in. That's not a bad ratio for this podcast. There's that. I had to stop watching after that. But there's also like how Dominic Cummings and his wife don't have any friends or family in London who could help them with childcare, and they felt the need to go up to Durham. Why the trip to Barnard Castle was on his wife's birthday.
Well, with his wife and kid in the vehicle whilst he's going out to test his eyesight as well. Yeah, there's just the entire thing just falls apart at even the slightest bit of scrutiny. It's clearly just a load of hokum that's been made up to try and provide a reason for kind of like being out and about and breaking the lockdown that wasn't just "I felt like it."
So what I don't get is, it would be perfectly possible when this story broke, I think, about Thursday or Friday.
Yeah.
And it would have been possible, but the line could have been that Cummings acted daftly, but had understandable concern for the safety of his young child. He was worried that he had symptoms, his wife had symptoms, and in a moment of madness, decided to drive halfway across the country. And obviously that is terrible, and I accept responsibility, and I resign, and you resign then, and then that means in 18 months, 2 years' time, Cummings can come quietly back into the number 10 operation in the run-up to a future election. I don't understand why Downing Street didn't do that.
My suspicion is because he's probably one of the few people that actually has any idea what the government's meant to be trying to do. Johnson doesn't have a clue about what it is he actually wants to achieve as Prime Minister, so he isn't providing any actual ideological vision. The vast bulk of the cabinet are yes men and cronies who have been put in their position because they are not going to challenge Johnson's authority. And as a result, if somebody like Cummings vanishes from government, the government probably just stalls. It would continue doing the things that it would do, it was already doing, but it really just becomes a case of, well, what after that? And there's no one there to actually provide that intellectual rigour or vision beyond just let's keep things moving.
The fact that that's true, certainly feels true, is a very depressing, reveals a lot about this government, and it reveals a lot that is intensely depressing, though. I think it also reveals a lot about the kind of conservatism that the Conservative Party is becoming, because I think Paul Gooden on Conservative Home sort of, he doesn't quite say it as bluntly as you do, because it'd be hard to run Conservative Home if you did. But he had a blog that's sort of talking about how it's understandable that people are having a go at Cummings because he's a proven centre-right election winner. But he's not he wasn't a Conservative member. He's not a mainstream Conservative in terms of like a One Nation mode, or much more a populist, really.
Yeah, he can't even claim he's a Thatcherite, really. Pretty much any kind of recognisable strain of right-wing ideology, Cummings doesn't really fit into it, which in a lot of ways is why he's an interesting figure to look at and to study, and why in a lot of ways he was an interesting choice for Johnson to bring in, both for the election and in government. But the fact that he isn't a Conservative with a small C means that he is very much separated from the rest of a Conservative tradition and the rest of the Conservative Party itself. I mean, and you can see that from the fact that whilst there are Conservative MPs going out to bat for him, you have a significant number of Tory MPs from all wings of the party coming out and saying, no, he needs to go. Peter Bone and Steve Baker have both come out and said, no, he needs to go. These are very much on the right of the party. These are very much the sorts of people you would expect to back a right-wing government that was kind of like more right-wing in its essence than moderate, which is what we have in theory with this government. But they don't like Cummings. None of them really like Cummings. People either don't like Cummings or they've had no interaction with Cummings. Because that's one of the things I've noted with an awful lot of the Conservative Party MP statements that I've seen online, is they've been saying, whilst I've never met Dominic Cummings, whilst I've never had any real interactions with him, all of that that kind of language. Which leads me to the conclusion that Dominic Cummings hasn't tried to win any friends amongst the Conservative MPs, which in turn means that the only person he's probably got backing him is Boris Johnson. So he's actually always been in probably a precarious position.
Okay, understand why you're not going to resign, fine. But there's two other things then. One of them is you could at least say that you'd done something wrong, because as lots of people have pointed out, some Labour MPs, say, have broken lockdown, say, gone to funerals that weren't socially distanced. I mean, just this week, you've had Leo Varadkar, who's the Irish Taoiseach, who pictures emerged of him out having a picnic topless with some other friends. You've got the Austrian president, who was in a restaurant beyond the 11 o'clock curfew the government has sent. It's not just Cummings, it's not a left-right issue. But the MP in question, who he had to put out a statement acknowledging that what he'd done was wrong and saying that what he'd done, he shouldn't have done. Now, Leo Varadkar hasn't as yet, in the media pieces I've seen. But the Austrian president has, and they've come out and said that what they did was wrong and they shouldn't have done it. But yeah. Cummings hasn't.
In a lot of ways, I feel like it's probably the core thing that actually is probably going to be the major issue behind all this. You know, the British people don't like hypocrisy in general, but it's just the fact that when given multiple opportunities to apologise and show contrition and just basically say, yeah, you know what, I done screwed up, you know, my bad. Refuse to do so. And I think that's the thing that's actually probably going to get on people's wick more than anything else. Everyone makes mistakes. And when you're a government advisor, they can be doozies. But if you show contrition and apologize and say, you know what, I got it wrong, this was the wrong call, people will go, okay, yeah, sure, fine, we can move on. Because at least on the surface, you're demonstrating that you might have learned something from it. But he hasn't done that. In fact, he's outright refused to do that. And I think that is what's probably caused a big, a significant amount of the shift in people's perceptions of the government that we've seen with the first poll that came out earlier today showing, I think, what was it, like a 16% decrease in Johnson's ratings, or the bulk of this fieldwork would have been done before Dominic Cummings' press conference. So that could drop further. We could be seeing voter intention polls showing a sharp decrease in the Conservative vote in some capacity. There's a lot of ways this can play out negatively for the government, and it's all fundamentally because they've just, for some reason, well, I say for some reason, I think we do know why, Boris Johnson has decided that Dominic Cummings is like our utmost priority to his administration. Again, in a way, a lot of people are kind of saying, well, why would he do this? This has never happened before. But actually, there kind of already has been an incident within this own, with this very government, of a similar thing happening, where Saeed Javid was basically lost his position as as chancellor because the options were you keep Javid or you keep Cummings. And Johnson chose Cummings and brought in Rishi Sunak, who he could control, or who Cummings could control.
We did a Patreon episode on when Keir Starmer's approval rating when he first became leader and comparing it to other Labour leaders and talking about the approval ratings of prominence historically. Now, if you want to, listeners, you can go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/notenoughchampagne, to check it out. But one thing that we talked about in that is the massive fall in Gordon Brown's approval rating after the farrago of the election that never was.
Mm-hmm.
I've just checked the polling, and Gordon Brown's approval rating goes from a +30 approval rating on the 6th of October, 59 approve, 29 disapprove, to a -1 approval rating where 37 approve, 38 disapprove. So that's a 31-point drop in that 17 days. And Johnson's dropped 16 in 4. And so, I mean, we've talked about, there's been a bit of a rally around the flag effect, and that is definitely going. On Cummings specifically then, something that Steve Richards has said, which I think is very, very interesting, and I think definitely plays into why this has hit politically. A lot of the stuff that Cummings has worked on before, it's been, well, on quite esoteric issues, which are quite difficult to sort of generalise and understand. So he made his fame with the campaign for a Northeast Regional Assembly, which is a bit of a technical issue and not exactly an issue that most ordinary people have much of a say on. I mean, the same with the European Union, really. Like, we've talked a lot on the podcast about issues of sovereignty, issues of trade. They're not necessarily ones which are easy to get your head around, the intricacies of trade deals or this sort of thing. Whereas the issue of the virus is very different in two ways. One of them is it's something that everyone has had to take part in. And there has been a real massive nationwide effort. Like, we've talked already, like, the government underestimated just how compliant the British public have been with the lockdown. 91% supported it when it was brought in. There's still not a lot of support for easing lockdown measures. And so everyone has taken part in a big communal sacrifice that they see sort of Dominic Cummings urinating on, essentially. And the other thing then is that actually it's a very, very easy, clear-cut issue. Like, people know, well, actually, if you've got a cold, you probably wouldn't go and see your grandma or see your parents because you don't want to give them an illness. And that goes doubly when you think you might have a coronavirus. You don't drive halfway out the country from London, one of the hotspots, to Durham, which hardly had any cases at all. So I think there's a couple of reasons why it really has cut through in a way that a lot of other scandals haven't.
I think you have got it boiled down to the core issue there, in that what we are meant to do and the impact of the lockdown, what it's meant to achieve, are really easy to explain. You stay in the house to stop the spread of the virus. Not everybody may agree with it, but everybody grasps that concept, which means that when you have someone who does breach the lockdown rules, people are much more likely to get aggravated by that. And it isn't just necessarily in the case of, say, Dominic Cummings. You can see plenty of things online of images of people on beaches or in parks enjoying the sun or just going out and about in groups. People retweeting, sharing things on Facebook, being very disdainful of these individuals, because people understand this is what we're meant to be doing, because this is what happens if we don't do it. And so when you have a high-profile individual like Dominic Cummings, who is basically the heart of Johnson's administration, I'd say, all people can see is the government not listening to its own advice, which cuts deep when you've been trying to do your best, follow the advice in good faith that this is the best outcome for everybody involved. And when you see someone who set the rules not obeying them, that stings. It really does, genuinely stings. Like I'm in a relatively comfortable position compared to a lot of people, I think, in this lockdown, but like, it still sucks. And I think everybody at this point in the lockdown is just feeling it now, because it's been, what, week 10 is this?
I think it's week 10.
Everyone's starting to get antsy. Everyone's starting to get a little bit stir crazy. And then at the exact point where everybody's kind of really feeling it, they see a massive example of someone from the government completely ignoring the rules.
So, yeah, it's a massive slap in the face to that collective effort.
Yeah.
The other thing that I don't get, just in terms of in terms of how the government's mismanaged this scandal, is the changing defences that number 10 has got. Because if you have a big scandal, you sit down with the person involved and you say, right, tell me everything that came out. What's the worst case scenario? Is this all there is? Now, either that didn't happen or Cummings didn't say the full truth. And the reason I say that is because originally, again, when the story came out, number 10 dismissed the reports that Cummings had taken a trip to Barnard Castle. And Grant Shapps on Sunday, so this is only, what, 2 days ago as we were recording this, on Sunday, Grant Shapps went on a Sunday show, presumably because he's a masochist, and said that Cummings has stayed in one place, which isn't true. How is that basic crisis management step of getting all the information out there and then having your story accordingly? I can't understand for the life of me why that hasn't happened in this case.
Because I suspect, and this is, you know, obviously just my opinion, that Dominic Cummings lied to Boris Johnson. I think when somebody did sit him down and say, did you go anywhere else? He went, no, of course I didn't. Because like, he was like, oh, no one's going to know I went to Barnard Castle. And then he got found out. That's fundamentally the thing here, is that Dominic Cummings genuinely believes he is superior to pretty much everybody else. He thinks his intelligence and his way of thinking means he is a superior being. It would not surprise me one bit if we were to discover down the line that Cummings had lied to Johnson to his face, or lied to whoever it was that was in charge of asking these sorts of questions to him, because he just didn't care that he was lying. There was one thing I read, to a degree, take this with a grain of salt. There was one an expert in body language who had kind of like worked a lot with psychopaths, not just in the serial killer sense, but just people who are clinically psychopathic. What she basically said was, when Cummings walked away from the press conference, she recognized a very familiar smirk and smile that came across his face, which she said was basically very similar to a lot of the psychopaths that she had worked with in the past who felt they'd gotten away with something. obviously armchair diagnosis, all of these sorts of things, but would anybody actually be surprised?
I mean, obviously the Goldwater Convention does apply.
I
would say it's a bad misreading of the politics of the situation if he thought he'd got away with it, because we've now seen polling. I mean, and this is the thing. So the way it was left last night, and we had a bit of a conversation. Listeners, we do try and have conversations that aren't recorded. We're not Richard Nixon. And sort of the way that we left it last night was we'd have to look at the polling. We knew it was big, but how big it became depended on where the polls shifted. And even a day or two ago, 52%, that magic number, 52% of people thought that Dominic Cummings, I think, should resign. That figure's now gone up to 59%. So that's only just a couple of days gone up 7 points.
Yeah, and including a majority of Conservative supporters also thinking he should resign as well.
And it's a misreading of the politics. And again, I think this is something Steve Richards has talked about, which is the stories that Cummings and Johnson tell about themselves, or certainly seem to think about themselves, are a bit unraveled at this as well. So obviously Cummings likes to see himself, and a lot of his campaigns portray himself as being an ordinary person against the sort of liberal elite, sort of US culture war style, which is talked quite a bit on the podcast, you know. So the idea is that the only people who cared about this were left-wing campaigning newspapers, which then is hard to reconcile with, as you say, Daily Mail headlines, Steve Baker, Peter Bone, Julie Hartley Brewer. You know, these are hardly left-wing Remainer campaigners here.
And some of them expressing vehemently, emotionally as well, why they were upset about this. Julia Hartley Brewer in particular was, when this story broke, was talking about how she basically had to go a month or two without seeing her mother, who had had a heart attack in December and was in need of care. Yeah, this isn't just lefties on Twitter making a fuss about this.
Sort of added to that on the kind of emotional reaction, and there are millions of different stories like that, but you've seen quite a few bishops who've been quite outspoken, and some of them have had a bit of stick. Something I thought was interesting that I saw on Twitter was a lot of bishops will have had to have turned dozens, hundreds of people away from attending funerals over the last few weeks. And so therefore you can understand their anger and frustration that someone feels they can flout lockdown regulations just because they think it's common sense.
Bishops coming out against what Cummings did didn't surprise me. What I was actually surprised by all of this was the vitriol that was put against them by some of Cummings' defenders. Like, you had Douglas Carswell calling for the actual disestablishment of the Anglican Church because of this, because bishops had the audacity to criticise Dominic Cummings and the government's handling of this affair.
And so you've got the Cummings thing, which is the Cummings detonating the story he tells about himself as this person who fights the elite but then is engaged in very elitist behaviour. But then the second aspect of that is the story Boris Johnson likes to try and tell about himself, that he is Britain's Churchillian leader who can steer his country through a terrible, dramatic period. I can't quite believe I've actually said that sentence out loud, but I suppose this is what 2020 has come to. I mean, we've sort of hinted at the fact that idea is coming apart, it seems, anyway. You know, the fact is, I mean, you talked about how you think Cummings lied to Johnson. Well, I mean, there's certainly an alternative explanation could be that just Johnson wasn't on top of the detail over the last couple of days. And it's that optimism, that lack of details, that, I mean, misspeaking, for instance, saying at the House of Commons last week or 2 weeks ago, I think, that the reason he had to have his botched TV statement go out on Sunday rather than being out in the House of Commons is because he wanted that to take effect on the Monday. But then that wasn't the case, because as we sort of talked about, that statement's announced on the Sunday, it then transpired the regulations were put in place for the Wednesday. So there's just a sort of massive failings all the way down the line. And frankly, and we've said this before, and it was obvious because lots of Tory MPs backed Boris Johnson for the leadership, even though in the past they said he wasn't up for the job. Well, what you're going to have on the back of this crisis is, I mean, there's been a lot of talk of cabinet ministers who've come out with the same line, lots of Tory MPs who've all put out the same tweet defending Cummings. But what will have happened on that Sunday when it became obvious that lots of cabinet ministers put out a tweet saying, well, no, it's because of the looking after his family, all this kind of stuff. And then the second story broke, is you're going to have a lot of pissed off Tory MPs, a lot of pissed off, quite humiliated cabinet ministers. And I don't think that leads to a very happy Tory ship.
I think you're right. We spent an awful lot of Theresa May's premiership having a little kind of countdown as to when she'd get all of the necessary letters into the 1922 committee to trigger a vote of no confidence. I believe we've started that countdown now for Boris Johnson. It really, I think, just probably is just going to be a matter of time if he continues on his current course for that to happen, because you can guarantee if he doesn't change direction soon, Peter Bone's probably putting one in. You know, Steve Baker probably going to be looking to work with the ERG to put a few in. So you could easily see potentially as maybe towards the tail end of this year, if things don't turn around for Johnson, that those go in and he has that crisis of leadership. He has that leadership crisis where he needs to get all of the Conservative MPs to back him.
It certainly feels like, to bring in a Churchillian phrase, the end of the beginning.
Yeah.
And maybe the clock is ticking, but we don't know how long that clock is ticking for. It could be years. I mean, for May, it was two, I suppose, if you're going to count it from the failing to win a majority in that snap election in 2017. It's probably 2 years from then till she resigned. The way I see it is almost, it feels like a very Margaret Thatcher type situation. I only say this because, as you've said, you know, that cabinet is quite a supine part cabinet. They are there because that Johnson's put them there. Johnson's won them this 80-seat majority only 6 months ago. He still does have a lot of authority. He's a dominating figure in that cabinet. But what I think happened with Thatcher is that there was a period in time where the cabinet turned against her very quickly. I can see that happening with Johnson. I can't quite see it happening over this.
No, but even if we just look at the coronavirus situation and lockdown and quarantine and all of that, there's still the track and trace that needs to be set up. He committed to a June 1st launch date for that, or whilst this has been going on in the background with Dominic Cummings, so God knows if that's going to be ready on time. The app for that, it hasn't been working properly, and there's lots of questions as to whether or not that's been handled properly as well. Just within this important but limited area in regards to like the coronavirus and COVID-19, there are plenty of kind of landmines ahead of him. Throw in the wider business of government as well. And the fact that Boris Johnson does not do detail well, does not do planning well, does not handle scrutiny well. He's going to set one or multiple of these landmines off, and it might be something really random that ends up bringing him down, but I think something is going to bring him down.
Is that an optimistic or a pessimistic end? I suppose it depends which side you're on.
Yeah.
You should probably be on the side, Steve, shouldn't you, to get access to unique content and special episodes and Zoom calls, shouldn't you, on our Patreon page?
Yeah, if you head to patreon.com/notenoughchampagne, you can gain access to our Patreon community, where, as Corey says, you can gain access to special content that we produce, discussions between us, some of our talking heads, such as Patrick Cook, our US ambassador, as I think I've ended up dubbing him in at least one episode. Head over there, throw us a few quid, gain access, more content, more fun.
Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. Our website is notenoughchampagne.com. James Cram designed the logo. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. And Dave Depper composed our theme tune, Fookie Good Times. I'm at Paperback Rioter.
I'm at Acoustic Radical.
Happy plotting.